I would say contribute to these open networks. Like, in order to get your work in front of people, there's kind of these two parallel paths, like making the stuff that is inherently interesting to you. And then, in my mind, adding a layer of you to these networks that already operate that way, that allow for your permissionless contribution. Make an OPEPN set is the TLDR, right? Or you go contribute to Nouns, go and get involved in these communities that have an appreciation for something already and add your flavor of contribution to that. And then outside of any of that is just publish and produce consistently. Xcopy's got one of my favorite quotes about being an artist. I don't know if I'm going to say this verbatim, but it was like, you want to be a better artist, make more art. Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to hear that answer. You want some like magical bean.
Yeah.
But there are no magical beans. In order to participate in the internet as an artist, unless you have, you know, entered 0.001% territory, you have to keep making stuff for people to look at.
Welcome to Zero Rights Reserved, a weekly podcast about Nouns, DAOs, NFTs, Ethereum, and more, brought to you by the Noun Square Media Collective. I'm your host, Tody Hawk, joined here by my co-host, Cardno, aka my favorite Nounish gummy toad. Today, we are hosting none other than the legend himself, Mr. Jack Butcher. Welcome, Jack. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, gents. I appreciate it.
Well, we'd love to start with talking about the person. There's lots of things to talk about, of course, all your different projects and all of your art. But we'd love to hear a little bit about your journey to start things off. So maybe we could kind of ask, go way back and just ask, like, what did you study at school? You know, what are the formative years of Jack?
Yeah, so I grew up in the UK and didn't think of myself as a designer or an artist until probably quite late in my journey, compared to the stories you hear, you know, of kids that are making stuff or creating art when they're 3, 4, 5. I'm not sure that was me, but when I got to 15, 16 years old, I in the UK school system, you have to do what's called work experience, or at least where I went to school, you had to do that. So there's like a 1 week work placement that either the school arranges for you, or you go out and figure out yourself, try and get permission from a business to go and sit in there for a week. And at the time, my cousin was a graphic designer, still is a graphic designer, but he was working in this design studio in Nottingham, which was about 3.5 hours away from where I grew up. And I don't remember the specifics of how it came about, but faced with all the options I had from the school, it was like, go and work in a supermarket or a bus station or a train station or something. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to try and do something a little bit different, more interesting. So I hit him up on organized within the family to go and stay up there for a week.
So we almost got bus driver, Jack. It was pretty close.
Could have been, man. Yeah. So I, at the time, I was really into skateboarding. So my, you know, spent all of my time outside of my, required, you know, extracurricular activity was just skateboarding all nights, weekends, and got this 1 week placement in his design studio. And that was the assignment, was basically, you know, conceptualize a skateboarding brand from scratch, you know, sit on a Mac and just make stuff for a week. And at the time, I think I had a old Windows PC, didn't have any design software. I wasn't messing around with that stuff. Personally, and that was just a sort of a life-changing experience, sitting there for a week extracting
just Microsoft
ideas.
Microsoft Paint.
I can't even remember what it was. It was like, what was it back in the day? Quark Express. Quark, I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but yeah, like maybe Adobe, maybe Illustrator. Yeah, so I kind of got exposure through that to this idea that that is something that you could earn a living doing, which was sort of a mind-blowing concept to me, because even the idea of a graphic designer was different in my head before I went and sat in a studio and did it. You know, I thought it was, you know, designing menus and signage for local businesses and things of that nature. You didn't never really put two and two together that all the stuff that I loved in the skateboarding shop, somebody somewhere was artworking that up, coming up with this stuff and building all of this incredible lore around these businesses and brands. So I think that was where the seed was planted. Eventually found my way to university to study graphic design, but by way of getting a few jobs first. So persuaded myself that I just needed to go and get a job, not go study at university. And I ended up working at a bunch of different places. I worked at Honda, the big Honda factory where I grew up. So I was putting together Honda Civics for 9 months or so before I went to university. I worked at a commercial printers, which is, I don't know if I'm just sort of retroactively piecing this stuff together, but they had a client, this magazine called Graphic Magazine, which was just this really high-end graphic design magazine that was 200 different types of paper, all these different print finishes, showcasing all of these. You know, it's like industry people talking to industry people. It's probably the same in every industry, but this was just a perfect example of like the best of the best in class and all exhibit in one place. And I saw that and I was like, sort of, I guess, reminded of the fact that I was had a little glimpse at what the people that are contributing to that, what their work was like. And then went and studied university, came out of university, got an internship in London, and was commuting back and forth 3 hours a day to that internship until I met a couple guys in a Wetherspoons for our UK listeners who had a friend that worked for Virgin Atlantic that could get almost free flights to New York. So you just pay the tax. I think it was about £70 at the time, which was just within my budget as a, you know, working on it. I can't remember how I was earning money. I'm working in a co-op or something, doing a free internship. Came over to New York, sent 150 emails to Craigslist postings for graphic design help. Got one response from a guy who was like 20-year Madison Avenue advertising veteran that was just started his own little boutique agency. And he sort of took me under his wing, so to speak, and sponsored me, brought me over properly. And we did a couple of years work with him, and then kind of bounced around the agency scene for almost a decade after that in New York.
That's awesome.
I was laughing at Tony because I literally had a lunch at Wetherspoons like 4 hours ago, and it's like, let's just say it's like rough and ready. If you when you go to London or something, Tony, go to a Wetherspoons, they'll hook you up. Yeah. Jack, I was doing like a deep dive, and you went to university in Cardiff as well, didn't
That's
you?
So you're correct.
A honorary Welshman yourself.
Indeed, man.
Nice.
What's the Wetherspoons on next to the train station in Cardiff?
Prince of Wales, is it?
Prince of Wales.
There we go.
Prince of Wales, absolute classic.
Prince of Wales, massive.
So this is great because you'll be able to understand Cardinals questions, etc.
Just about
100%. And well practiced.
You're growing up in Cardiff, but I think you sort of went into that yourself, really, of how you got to New York. But I just, from my own perspective, somebody who's like grown up in South Wales, like that leap from studying Cardiff University to arriving in New York City, you know, ready to take on the world, you know. Apart from these conversations you've had with people and obviously all the emails you sent via Craigslist, like what really convinced you when you're in the UK to like make that leap? Because I don't think people understand if you're from America, if you're in New York, it might seem if you're going from LA to New York City to live, it's not that big a thing. But having grown up and having studied yourself in Wales, it's like such a massive, you know, it's polarizing, mm-hmm. like the difference between the two. So I was wondering, you know, what was the sort of eureka moment where you're like, right, I need to go?
You know, what's funny, the I actually went for like 3 days with these two guys that I met before going back to do this thing. So I went about a month before I graduated. I went over there for 3 or 4 days with these guys, mm-hmm. and we stayed in Times Square. So just like complete mind bending, like not really a reflection of what New York is, even really. You know, go. As a tourist, the first time you're in Times Square, you do the, you know, the go up the Empire State Building, do all that stuff. And I think the initial impetus for it came from like, I never did the gap year or the like take time out and go to, you know, I had friends that went to Thailand for 9 months. Or, yeah, exactly. Just like people that had maybe gotten advice from, I don't know, their parents or people a little bit older than them, like go and do something before you're like locked into working on your career or trying to, you know, build a reputation in something really specific. You're young, you have no responsibilities, go and have a good time, right? So I was like straddling this thing where I was like, oh, I have this opportunity to go to New York, haven't traveled a great deal. My dad actually was in the Navy for 22 years while I was growing up.
Oh, nice.
And he was back and forth from the States, and he's always talking about it. Up until, you know, 20, 30 years afterwards, he's like, oh, I did this in America. I did that in America. It was, this was so good. And I guess that was like sort of playing in the back of my mind too. When I got the opportunity to go, I was like, yeah, I'll go. Never did I think I'm going to stay there for, you know, 12 years, start a family, blah, blah, blah. It was just, this seems like a great experience to get temporarily, then, you know, come back and understanding sort of how the design world works, I think was influential in that too, where you could go do a stint at an agency, complete a project, you know, move to another agency or freelance here, freelance there. It was like, you know, even if I was going to go for 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, I would have exposure to things that would make me a better designer, you know, help me meet people in the design world. So I didn't initially, if I'd have thought of it as, oh, I'm going to move there forever, I probably wouldn't have gone. I thought it was like, you know, just a couple of month experiment.
Looks good on the CV when you get back to the UK that you've got like a body of work in NYC. Like people go, oh, okay.
Yeah. It's exactly was my thinking at the time.
It's funny that you mentioned that little bit on family lore, because I remember a tweet recently from Wilson Cusack where he talked about bringing his kids to Disney World or something, and everybody was telling him, don't bother bringing your kids under two. They won't remember anything. And he's like, for me, it's like, you're just like making family lore that like, whether they remember it or not, they'll talk. And then that story about your dad saying, oh, you know, I did this in America, I did that in America. At the time, you're probably like, sure, pops, but it ended up influencing you in some way as an adult.
For sure. Yeah. I think that's definitely all of this stuff. Again, at that point, I never thought I would be on a podcast explaining these decisions either. So the ties that I'm making, I don't even know if they're even accurate. It's like,
are you fixing it in post right now?
Exactly. Yeah, I did this and then I intentionally made this decision and that. No, it was like, here's the most logical thread to explain the outcome. It may not be, you know, there are probably other motivations at the time that were not as pure as let me get this on my CV. It's probably, you know, let's go to New York, got on the piss four nights a week with a couple of like lads I just met. That was probably the main motivation at the time.
You heard it here first from Jack. The key to success. Pick a city, go with your mates, get pissed for 4 days.
Yeah.
Profit.
It's the way.
I mean, it definitely was, that's definitely a foundational component of the journey for sure. Was just FAFO, as the kids are calling it these days.
That must be a UK reference. I don't know.
You've seen the memes, Toadie.
Fuck around and find out, Toadie.
Oh, yes. Looks like I just fucked around and found out. Yeah,
exactly.
All right. let's talk visualized value. So how did that come to be? When did you decide to sort of strike out on your own? And tell us about that story, please.
So the agency world was probably 8 or 9 years of similar but very different experiences. So I started at this really small boutique shop and worked on more traditional stuff like TV ads, like print, magazine. This is 2011. So there are digital agencies there, like that stuff is coming about, but it's not anywhere near what it is today. You know, like even to build an e-commerce website is like a $10 million endeavor. When I was starting my career, that was like an unthinkable challenge for most creative shops. So I kind of bounced around all these different places. I started in this boutique shop, doing a lot of traditional work, branding work. That guy that started that eventually took a job at Bloomberg. I went in-house for one of our clients at the time, which was like a fabric technology company. So that was like family-owned business. And that was just to keep my visa to stay in the States, basically. I was like, okay, this is not my dream job by any means, but I don't want to leave, so I'm going to go do it. And did that for 6 months. Then I ended up at this big consulting, like digital consultants called Sapient, 13,000 employees, designed MSNBC.com back in 2012, like just huge digital projects. And then went to Bloomberg, where that guy who originally brought me to the States was the executive creative director of Bloomberg. Went and worked there for 9 months, worked on Bloomberg Business, the like all of their media properties, web design stuff. and then just bounced around doing all sorts of stuff, like little agencies, big agencies, startups, so doing UX, UI design, like building products, ads, basically every commercial application of design in that, in the New York agency world. I had a little bit of exposure to it through 8 or 9 years. And then cockily, after 8 or 9 years, you're like, oh, you know what? I can do this better than every agency I've worked at. And the reason I had that inclination was I kind of got high enough up the ladder to be able to see the economics of the businesses. When you're starting out, you have no idea what you're earning relative to what the company is making, right? Nobody's showing you the P&L when you're a junior employee. But when you're pitching clients and when you're like budgeting out jobs, you get more of a sense of how they cost this stuff and what it costs to run a business. And when you're, I was at the time, you know, 26, 27 or something, endless energy, you know, like 18, 19 hours a day, I'll be awake working on this stuff for somebody else. And you'd see that, oh, this job that you worked on for 3 months and you know you did 90% of the work, you're taking home 2% of what you worked on.
Yeah.
And there's obviously a ton of nuance to that because like the work itself is not really what they're paying for. They're paying for the client service. They're paying for the like all of these like intertangled parts that are this just a function of corporate America being this bloated beast. Right.
Paying for the bullshit.
The bullshit tax is 98% in that environment. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, I can do this better. I managed to get like a client through an agency I used to work at that was trying to like reduce their costs a little bit, which was great for me. But essentially, I just started doing 10 people's jobs and their expectations were still the level of service they were getting at these big, big businesses. So my youthful energy and my naivety carried me for probably 6 to 9 months doing that. And then just eventually was like, this is not, you basically reach a fork in the road. Like I can't physically sustain this. So I need to either hire people or I need to completely pivot what we're offering. And I decided I didn't want the, you know, Manhattan office bill and the 10 salaries and all of that and going out and basically building the thing that you just left is essentially the path there. And
then having to do all the bullshit and not the creative, not the creative part.
Exactly. Yeah. And props to anybody who's doing that. This is not me saying that that's not any, not something that shouldn't be done. It's just, it's not something that I wanted to do. So made that decision. And then just, there's probably like 5 or 6 different iterations of the solo agency business after the fact. So I was like, okay, I'm going to focus on just automotive clients. That's going to be my thing. I'm going to do car stuff only. But that really doesn't, that doesn't change the nature of the business at all. It's like it might be slightly better focus on the inbound stuff, but you're still pointing in a million different directions. I can't even remember all the things I tried to do, but oh, we're just going to do this format of media. I did a podcast agency where I would take an hour of audio, write articles, build clips, do this. This was probably 6 years ago now. And that was a nice little business, but soul sucking, not very enjoyable.
And this is before everyone and their dog had a podcast.
Exactly right. That was back in the, that was back early days. This led me to that. I think there was actually some of the like genesis of Visualized Value was in that idea. It's like taking people's ideas and then distilling them or taking the best parts of them. And Visualized Value became this, I guess this process that I would take an idea and turn it into something that was distilled in some way. And that became the thing that I started offering businesses. So if you have something that's really hard to explain, let's sit down for 2 or 3 hours, just throw it all at me. I'll write notes. I'll take, you know, sketch some stuff out, come back to you in a couple of days with, here's the most poignant thing about the thing you're trying to say. Here's a couple of images that capture the essence of the value proposition. Or if you're trying to raise capital, here's what investors care about, how you're going to pay them back and why anybody's going to be interested in this in the first place. And that was a healthy little thing. Like people instantly saw the value in that. I was able to create things that represented exactly what I could do, what I wanted to do. This process was take ideas that were interesting to me regardless, right? I'd be reading a book, I find an idea I like, and then I would just post it up. And it became this natural way to introduce me to people that were looking for that process to be applied to something that they were trying to communicate. And that was a healthy little service business for a year or so. And then just so much inbound that I couldn't fulfill all of the requests I was getting to do, like the belly to belly client work, like have the conversation, make the thing. So like, oh, here's an opportunity to productize this in some way, right? People are trying to learn this skill. They're trying to distill what they're trying to say into something diagrammatic and simple. Made a little curriculum, and I was doing a lot of back and forth on Twitter, very similarly to how all of this all of the last 6 months have played out. But at the time, there's a guy called David Perrell has a writing school, and he tweeted out that the thing I'm really looking to learn right now is how to add visuals to my writing to really create more impact, help people understand the points I'm trying to make. And I just quote tweeted that and said, I could put together a little curriculum on this. Is anybody interested? Massive amounts of interest. I threw up a pre-order page same day, and I launched this product called How to Visualize Value. And yeah, just kept building from there. So that became the first product.
The rest is history.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. We could go into the nuances of how it evolved from there. But yeah, it was a really terrible service business to begin with, then like slightly less terrible, then really focused, and then like mostly product and a little bit of service, and then just product. And now we're on the evolution past that.
Yeah. Now mostly not terrible. We're on the other side.
Indeed. Indeed.
Definitely. Obviously, we've gone through visualized value probably at a canter there, but I'm interested in knowing, at what point in that journey did you fall down the sort of crypto rabbit hole? And, you know, what attracted you to crypto at first? Was it, you know, were you one of those people who was just trading coins, or did you see an NFT project that caught your eye? So what made you fall down that rabbit hole?
Two things. So one was I actually had a visualized value client that was a crypto hedge fund.
Helps.
I was trying to explain what a blockchain is to their LPs. And I made a 15-page deck, I think, with an explanation of what a blockchain is, the most distilled I could at the time. And this was probably 2017. So that was when I was first like down the rabbit hole.
You know that meme where the dog's at the computer, like, I have no idea what I'm doing? I love that idea of just like, you're learning by like making an explainer for someone else's business.
Yeah, bizarre. And at the time, like, they had the conviction, and through hearing them talking about it and trying to visualize it, that obviously transferred some conviction to me, because I'm still, still believe in the fundamental principles that I learned going through that process with them back then. And then kind of faded away. That was like a brutal price action. I remember I put a little bit of money into Bitcoin back then. And then you had I can't even remember what that cratered down to, but it was like terrible, terrible price action. I didn't have,
not great.
I did not have disposable income at that point in time. So it was just like, oh, well, that's cool. We'll see if that comes back. I'll focus on, doing the stuff that I'm good at, and kept working with other businesses. And then when visualized value became this more digitally native productized thing with its own community of people gathering in Discord and Twitter, all these different platforms, some of the people that had been attracted to those pieces of work that had been out for the last couple of years were like, hey, Jack, have you heard of NFTs? You should look at this. Like, you've been posting digital art for the last 2 years. You know what an NFT is. Here's someone sent me a link to OpenSea. This was mid-2020 probably. And I remember opening OpenSea, and it did not click for me initially. I was like, oh, this is interesting, but it feels like, I don't know, maybe like a like a video game you don't understand or something you've been dropped in the middle of, and it's like, I don't have the context to see the value in this at all. And then kind of went, probably a couple months passed by, and then somebody showed me Foundation, the invite only one of one platform, and then it instantly clicked. Like, oh, okay, this is the, you know, the digitally native, beautifully designed, curated network of both displaying and auctioning digital art. So then it clicked, and I was like, I have to get an invite for this thing. I have to go back and remember who invited me to that.
Shows you the importance of context, I guess.
Yeah, 100%. It was like, at the time, if I think you probably could have bought a CryptoPunk for $500 when I was first introduced to that. And it's just, yeah, it really is a fascinating thought experiment to run, because I think if I'd have been given the same information, or if I'd have, it's just really, it's really hard to understand what I would have needed a year earlier to have understood it. But it had to be contextualized in like how I could contribute to it, or why it might be valuable to me and the people that are interested in what I'm doing. Then just the whole thing like clicked. And March, must have been, I think it was March 2021, I minted my first one of one on Foundation, and didn't have a crypto community whatsoever. Like, the stuff that I'd been talking about wasn't crypto. The like the public facing visualized value content and the things that I would write about were way more about this idea of, I mean, there's overlapping themes for sure, like putting yourself out there on the internet, building a network of people that appreciate what you do, trying to articulate what is uniquely interesting to you, and trying to attract opportunity based on your ability to articulate that. So there were some overlapping themes, but the work was not inherently crypto native or referential of the like crypto themes of in crypto until, I don't know, probably three or four pieces later. I was like, man, the same feedback loop exists here, right? Like, all of these ideas that are informing how this technology works can be part of this work. And why do people want to own artwork at any given time? Because it's a commentary on what's happening in the world at that time. Why do I want to make it? Because I want to capture this moment in time. So that's when it really started to click for me. So it went from, okay, I can take this thing that I'm already posting to Instagram and Twitter and give it some digital provenance outside of those networks that I'm renting on, right?
Put it's this, like putting the zeitgeist on the chain almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In some cases, not even the zeitgeist, just like the thing that I'm making, I'm going to basically double post it to Ethereum. And if somebody wants to own it, great.
Right.
Versus, oh, okay, now I've like building a network through people purchasing these things. I'm like, oh, wow, there are like ideas here that are fundamentally different to how we're used to thinking about value, the internet, you know, the way in which people produce and consume content. And that's when I started to really like point all of the work I was minting in the direction of those very specific themes. Like, one of the most successful quote unquote piece that I ever minted was called NFTs Explained. And it's a articulation of the difference between a JPEG and an NFT, which uses the blue check, you know, sort of the genesis of that idea back 2 years ago. And yeah, those that then it really felt like the Venn diagram was closing in on itself in a very good way, and the feedback loop was getting much better. So
it reminds me a lot of the philosophy that Jacob at Zora has sort of been espousing, with just like mint everything, and how like as a creator sometimes it can be discouraging because you'll mint things out but no one will buy them sometimes, but also sometimes you tweet and no one likes. So
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
You've been talking about this week a little bit about your Facebook post and about how you made this piece of art that nobody liked and so you burned it, but now you regret that.
Yeah. No, it's like that, I think, is the downside of the commercial component of it, or like the degree of euphoria that emerged around this in 2021 was actually harmful in the short term, right? The unsustainable behavior that existed around this is like has tainted the fundamental quality of it in a lot of people's eyes, deservedly so in a lot of cases, right? So you look at this, some of these headlines, just like, what are these people doing? You know, and it was nuts. I'm a huge fan of Jacobs, and the idea that this is really about a behavior that we're trying to change. And if I look back at my career as a digital artist, do I wish that every single piece I'd made was minted on Ethereum on the day I made it, so I'd have this immutable record of this stuff that is composable, and I can pull it into this platform or that platform or here or here or here? I've had my Twitter account banned on Visualized Value. I've like some posts I've double posted, or I've like, there's just a completely, it's hard to really articulate it, I think, until you've gone through the process of minting the thing. I have equated it in the past to the modem connecting to the internet for the first time when you're a kid. It's like this moment that you're not really sure why it's special or different at the time, but you just feel something that's like, wow, this is a crazy thing that just happened. And that's how I felt the first time I ever minted anything.
And then your mom picks up the phone and you're like, Mom!
They're off the internet.
Exactly. We're probably all similar age, so we have similar technical milestones in our histories. But that idea of, you know, in the same way that the internet was getting attacked as like a superfluous technology and compared to the fax machine and blah 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 blah, I think we'll see all of those comparisons in time look exactly the same way, right? Like, the idea of being able to preserve the things you're making, like the output of your work being preserved and maintained by 200,000 incentivized nodes around the world, rather than, you know, uploading to ad server X that monetizes on top of it. And we're starting to see a little bit of a change around that now. But I just think this is just the perspective, the digital art perspective, or arguing for it from that perspective, is in the same way a museum authenticates the paint or the age of the canvas that was painted, and that informs the context of the painting. This feels like the equivalent to someone who only works digitally. You now have a medium to authenticate your work, to create the social contract between you and whoever, or just yourself, of, I made this on this day for this reason, and I'll either refer back to this just as a personal object in 40 years, or transfer it to my kids, or I can make a living transferring these things around because other people want to own them.
I've always found that to be ironic, where people kind of make that meme, the right click save as, but in reality, you know, these NFTs are actually more verifiable than the painting you might have on your wall, which could have been faked 200 years ago and you have no idea.
Yeah. And I have had this, this thought for maybe the last 8 months. And this is another, I guess, retroactive observation, is that provenance is cumulative, right? It's like, what has come from a single address, or what has occurred between this network of addresses? You can make the argument that somebody like, you know, like New York Times or something, saying we're going to start minting newspaper articles from 1975. Or so, it's just ridiculous. It's just a stupid thing to do, right? It's like, doesn't make sense. It's like not a digitally native object. It's not happening on the day that the event happened. It's just a pure, like, it's like saying we're going to paint that front page on an oil canvas and then auction it off. It just makes no sense. But
that's proved out, by the way, too, even like with like Jack's first tweet and stuff like this, you know, that someone paid $5 million for, but it's like not valuable anymore.
Those are the arguments I think that are in that like 56k modem world, where it's like, if you don't get that, you're just not going to get it. Like, obviously the people that appreciate this stuff are borderline obsessed with the nuance of it. For good reason, right? The same in any other deeply appreciated thing in the world. Like, if you collect stamps, you have a very high appreciation for the importance of one versus another. But if you showed me two of them, I have no clue what's going on. But this idea, of context and cumulative provenance is the, hey, this stuff may never be interesting or valuable, but if in 2 or 3 years time you create this thing that garners a massive amount of attention, then you have this massive paper trail to connect it all back. And I think
that's what happened with you, right? Basically.
Yeah. There's like, I think there's a worthwhile argument for doing that, even if your goal is not, but let's be realistic, most people's goals are to get more attention on the work you're producing, right? You're putting it out for yourself, but also this observation you're trying to share with the world. I think that's a reasonably fair thing to ascribe to most people that publish things. They want it. They want other people to see them.
We all want that dopamine hit, let's be honest.
Exactly, exactly. And yeah, just normalizing this idea of verifiably publishing your work and transcending these platforms that come and go. And I guess you can make the argument that Ethereum is a platform in the same way what was Twitter, there's now X, is a platform. But the incentives to maintain Ethereum are very different than Twitter or X or whatever else, right?
Company and it's not just one guy. Yeah.
Exactly. So yeah, I think those nuances are the things that you're never going to be able to write a headline that captures that. It's about either being able to create, like have that experience of creating something and giving something real provenance, or collecting something that you love, that you want to support the creation of, or send some energy to the creator of the thing. Those are the only two ways in my mind, that get you invested in it to the point where it's just like finding out Santa isn't real, right? It's like you have this realization and that's just done. Like you're not waking up the next day like, oh, maybe. No, you're past the Rubicon, or the threshold has been crossed.
Wait, Santa's not real?
Sorry, I should have cleared that one before the pod.
Spoiler alert. I wonder if we're ever going to look back on our blockchain provenance with the same cringe that we do our, you know, Facebook history
there's another conversation to be had around that, where, you know, it does make you more thoughtful in some ways too, because this stuff is immutable by definition. Like there is a delicate decision to be made in each case, right? Like, would I have wanted to mint everything I ever wrote on Facebook? Absolutely not.
Please no.
But yeah. So I mean, I don't know. I'm 35 now, so I like to think that maybe at some point your judgment reaches a point where you are no longer
cringe,
randomly shooting shit into the void. Yeah. Cringe is a good way to summarize it.
Ashamed of what you're part of there.
It's like a cringe flatline. You know, you just level out eventually, ideally.
Yeah. Who knows? Maybe you don't. Maybe that's the goal, man. Maybe we should all be trying to evolve from our last level of cringe.
There's a 50-year-old watching this podcast right now, and they're like, no, man, trust me. Yeah. It's not done.
This goes on YouTube. Let's have something in the comments to verify this.
You touched on it a bit there, Jack, but I think we should probably speak about checks. And obviously, it's like a massive whole story in itself, but maybe about how the idea of checks come about. And I know you did touch on it there, but just go back through like how checks came about and, you know, how it evolved over time. And I appreciate like it's a long narrative and it's still ongoing, but maybe just sort of delve into it where you can.
Yeah, I tried to do a TLDR. So that initial reference to the blue check mark back in 2021, I think was, and maybe still is, one of the more succinct explanations of what an NFT is, which is ironic because now the commentary in the checks project is about the sort of waning value of the check mark. So the check mark used to symbolize this top-down verification mechanism, right? Like Twitter decides this person is notable, this person isn't. There was some process to go through where you send 10 press articles about yourself that
website and bio,
right, that you're exactly a notable person, and Twitter makes the decision whether or not you are notable. And
that's why everybody had to start a podcast so they could
exactly right. Get on Fortune, Forbes are 30 under 30, you know, all this stuff. So that to me was a massive shift in digital culture, when that, like, Elon, I think, referred to it as the lords and peasants system of social media. And I'd sort of satirize that in 2021 with the NFTs Explained, where the blue check mark represents the artist's signature on the image. Two images can be the same, but if it comes from this address and this person cross-references it on this profile, this profile, this profile, that is a verified contribution or something. And I guess the other commentary here is, like, people confusing the check mark with truth. It's not necessarily, it's not truth. It's like somebody said that. Like, yeah. this idea of, yes, I made this and I stand by the statement I made. It's not that this thing is true. The idea for checks originally, like, was just an image that kind of captured that moment in time. So the original open edition was, again, like this satirized Damien Hirst dots painting, yeah, where almost pointing to that as the legacy art world too, you know, like that is probably the most notable artist in the world, at least of the last 50 years or so, up there at least. So cheeky tongue-in-cheek reference to that, right? If the other reference to the platform was this caption that used to appear after the Elon takeover, where if you hovered over a blue check mark, it said, "This is a legacy verified account. It may or may not be notable," which just incredible. So
sometimes the memes write themselves.
Exactly. Borrowed that language and just changed the one word, said this artwork may or may not be notable. I think at the time just tapped into this thing that people had been talking about for months. I mean, it's just like so much social controversy around this thing. So the open edition did reasonably well at the time, considering everything's going on. I hadn't minted anything probably for a few months at that point. I just put it out $8 because the cost to get the blue check mark was $8. So another, like, commentary on the ability to purchase status. But if everybody can purchase it, then no, like, it, the meaning is reduced to zero, right?
Yeah.
The symbol no longer
is notable.
The same, yeah.
It carries the same weight, status. Or carries as much weight, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So you can buy it for $8. And then after this thing minted just over 16,000 identical pieces, I'd been in the world of, you know, one of ones, and probably had 60, 70 collectors of the one of one stuff at the time, and built great relationships with everybody that has bought that work. But noticed something after I'd minted that, there was just a very different energy around this stuff, where I think at the time people were, some people genuinely interacting with it, other people, like, saw an opportunity to, you know, get a story going around this and, you know, make some gains for themselves. But so many questions, like, what's happening next with this thing? I'm like, what's happening next? What do you mean? Like, I've just, it's done. And then I guess that question is just like cooking in the back of my mind. I'm like, wow, there really is something to be explored here, right? There's, like, so much built in meaning in this thing that you can really push it more. So the next couple months just spent, well, actually probably 6 weeks, just thinking about how can we further push on this question of digital status, notability, like the value of a check mark. And we conceived, we being me, Jalil, and Traf, conceived this mechanism for firstly taking this editioned image, you know, one of 16,000, and migrating it to an on-chain collection. So in my mind, that's the first kind of commentary you're making between fungibility and non-fungibility. So yeah, the check mark in the first instance represents your relationship with me and my ability to change that artwork, right? It's like, I can change that. And we spent the first 6 months changing the artwork on the checks grid to represent either a moment in time or something that's happening on Twitter that day.
I wonder if anyone registered all those changes. I was wondering that at one point, if someone, like,
so Zora, you can, I think you can enable it on Zora and you can go and scroll back through the history of it. So I'll do that. Yeah. So the first like comment we're making here is you can either choose to kind of keep this thing, this mutable artist controlled canvas, or you can use your Ethereum address to create something completely unique that we no longer have any custody or control or anything over. And that is another expression of the checkmark. If, depending on how you look at it, that's maybe a purer expression of it, right? It represents the energy you spent to create that thing, the gas that you paid to move it from one collection to another.
And it's immutable at that point.
Immutable, maintain like fully on chain, like the instructions to render this thing will live as long as Ethereum lives, right? And then we built a mechanism to combine them together, what we call compositing, which is the ability for a collector to combine these checks at different, I don't know how deep we want to go into this, but you, the grid you start out with, you can essentially combine that to get down to a single check on a canvas. And it takes 64 of the original editions to create a single check.
And how many are we up to now?
There's 40 right now.
40.
So the and the final part of the mechanism is this thing we call a black check, which takes 64 single checks to create, which was like a third of the original supply, right? Which is almost an unfathomable exercise, like very, very hard to do.
You have to coordination, it's impossible, yeah.
Yeah, either coordination or just a stupid amount of capital. It's so, it's it creates this very interesting tension and the whole collection is then a reflection of what people decided to do with those check marks after they owned them. And
it would be like the ultimate commentary of someone with a bunch of capital just eventually came in and, you know, purchased their way to the black check.
I think I'm one of the cool things I think that we thought of a couple of days before we launched the on-chain mechanism was to add a day trait. In the on-chain collection, every single check has a trait that references the day it was migrated or modified. So we can really visualize when all this activity happens. So on the first day, you have a huge spike of migrations. The 69th day, you have a huge spike of migrations, 100. And just being able to catalog that out, I think we just passed day 200. We're probably on like day 203, 204 right now. Just been an unbelievable thing to watch happen. And 40 people have built single checks. And we'll see what occurs over the coming years with that. It's been interesting to watch how the checkmark has been, the context of the checkmark has been changing in the context of Twitter too, where they just shipped a feature a couple of weeks ago where you can hide it. You can be a blue subscriber, but you can hide the check mark. I don't know if you guys saw that.
Didn't know.
Because outside of our like Twitter circle, where it's completely normalized to pay for the blue check because it's like part of, you know,
culture.
To participate in this ecosystem, that's what you do. Outside of that, the Elon controversy and the political connotations with paying Elon $8 a month.
Right.
Normally get you verbally abused on Twitter outside of any other context than crypto Twitter.
I love Elon's response to that being, well, you can still pay me and you don't have to tell anybody.
Exactly. So I think the master stroke is the ad revenue, right? You have to buy the checkmark to be eligible for the ad revenue.
Yeah. Right.
And then that has obviously converted a ton of people to premium and then they hide the blue check. So yeah, this idea honestly is interesting to me if this ends up being like the death of that symbol. You know, like does the symbol gradually grow to not represent anything in particular because you can buy it? And then it just becomes this superfluous icon, right? It's like, why do we need this anymore if it doesn't make a distinction between A or B?
Or does Elon change it? You know, he's right. Walked off and just changed things. So
yeah, and then in my mind, that's just an interest. Like as a piece of art, does checks get more or less interesting as a function of marking that moment in time? Where you look at that in 20 years, you're like, what is that?
Yeah,
what's that symbol? Like, I can't personally imagine a future where people don't know what that is, but very possible that in a few years' time, it will be eliminated.
Reminds me of videos that show like Zoomers, you know, computer icon, like the save icon on a computer, and they have no fucking clue.
That's a great analogy. Yeah, flip phone.
All this skeuomorphic stuff that we, you know, eventually becomes irrelevant. Like the telephone too. Like even on our phones today, that you got the telephone. Like most of the people using these phones have no idea what that is. They've never seen a telephone that looks like that.
Are you talking about the hand signal? Yeah. Well, kids do that.
That too. Hand but sack. I'm talking about like on an iPhone. If you look at the phone app, it still shows.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's a good point, too.
But yeah, that's a great point too. Like the kids are like this, and you're like, "What are you going to sleep?"
Yeah.
That's right. All right. Well, we've talked about checks. Of course, it's time to talk about Opepin. It started as a simple open edition, and it kind of evolved into this living, breathing, I don't know, museum on the blockchain. Maybe you could say it that way. Tell us about how that happened, because it started just as sort of an innocuous open edition, similar to checks.
Yeah, it was just a bit of fun originally. So I'm sure you guys know Bats. He made this collection in, I think, late 2022, Geometric Pepes, and deservedly blew up. It was great. And Jalil and I had been playing around with this idea, I don't know, 6 months before that, which became Punkscapes, his project, which were these 3x1 landscape. It's basically the first banner, Twitter banner project as an NFT. Had this very iconic ratio. So it was a kind of combination of those two things and just a bit of fun to begin with, and free mint for an hour in February, I think. And weirdly, almost to the number, reached 16,000 pieces. 15,984, I think, was the final number. And left it for a little while. Didn't really think of what we're going to do with it. What's it going to be? And then that one, I know that one just kept nagging at me in a different way, or presenting another question. So myself, Traf, Jalil, and Aaron Alto, we were working on a PFP project 2 years ago or something. It just never really felt like that. It never really felt like it got anywhere, or like never felt like there's anything worthy of pushing out. But still an incredibly interesting medium, right? Like as a digital artist, there's no denying that that is the medium that has the most attention and the most distribution. But it isn't based on most of the examples, it isn't a very artistic pursuit, right? It's like, how do you make 10,000 variations on the same thing? Everybody knows what I'm referencing with that. It's like one character dressed up in 10,000 costumes, and just wasn't an interesting, again, like the skeuomorphic, okay, that's worked, so let's just take that and change the ingredients and put it back out, was not interesting.
Also the fact that it wasn't really like notable to begin with, like everyone just did it because that's what punks did.
Yeah, exactly.
And as it turned out, looking back, like it almost certainly is too much for any collection.
Anyway. Yeah, I mean, there's what? How many active participants in this ecosystem right now? It's sub 10,000 a day, I'm fairly sure. So
yeah,
and there's probably 10 million of these things out there now. There's so many themes that came into this, one being like all of the things that are bizarre about that formula being a motivator to try and do something different. And obviously the amount of exposure something like that can get if done well, like the notifications tab, you know, when you're scrolling through your Twitter timeline, that stuff is everywhere. So that was like a lot of the impetus came from that and the creative challenge. Like, how can you do something that you would be truly proud of in this format? It's an incredibly hard thing to conceptualize. And eventually ended up at this idea of, okay, well, let's split the collection up into much smaller segments within that 16,000 and design something that is simple enough to kind of tie a creative thread through all of this and almost press on that idea that 10,000 is too many, or like the aesthetic, the very specific aesthetic is not enough to build a community around. It's like there has to be something bigger that unites these 10,000 people than, or 16,000 people in this case, than a, you know, a specific style of cartoons. This is kind of a very hard thing to maintain interest in. So that's where this idea of splitting the collection up into 200 different drops within 16,000 and kind of pre-assigning rarity, which is, again, attacking the way it has been done traditionally, where you blindly commit to these things and then maybe you get something you like, maybe you don't. Maybe you get something like hyper rare, maybe you don't. Versus kind of setting these parameters where the philosophy of the project or the fundamental pieces of the art are interesting to you. And then over time, these pieces get revealed and we get other people to contribute to it. We play around with all these different experiments. And yeah, it's been, I think we're what, 15 sets in so far. So that's 15 times 80. My math is not, it's like 1,300, 1,400, something like that, pieces yeah. out of 16,000. And yeah, it's been a phenomenal experiment. It is a lot of work. Like that, you know, when we propose that, it's kind of fascinating how you, I don't know, how the way it is received impacts the conceptual depth in the first 15 sets has kind of set the tone yeah. where you want to continue with that level of thought, craft, and care. And trying to be completely transparent that there is no set schedule, there is nothing outside of us producing art and trying to get consensus on that art that we're going to be doing until this thing is complete.
That's one of the things I loved about OpenPen from the beginning, is that I've always said since my beginning of involvement in the NFT space that, you know, roadmaps are just a recipe for everyone's disappointment, because these projects are trying to look a year, 2 years out, and they don't even know what the landscape of crypto is going to be like in 2 months, let alone 2 years. Right, and so they right. make all these giant promises, and inevitably, you know, you can look at Doodles, you can look at Yuga, all the big names, they've all disappointed more or less because of that. But I like how this, in this sense, you were just like, our roadmap is we're going to do a bunch of stuff for a while, you know? Like, at least
we know that we can like keep making variations of this thing until we reach the maximum supply. We know that. Like,
yeah.
It may be a massive amount of work, but we know it's possible, right? And we have demonstrated in public that it is possible, hopefully, at this point. And there were so many adapt. Different.
You can adapt yeah. as well to what changes in the world.
Yeah, it's like one of the massive, again, there's very similar to checks. There was just so many things converging at the time that one of the original ideas was to do this AI. It's actually a Nouns product, Nouns AI.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's built on Stable Diffusion, and it has this incredible ability to take this silhouette of anything and reinterpret it based on the prompts you give it and create these new visual outputs. And that was one of my first ideas.
Last night.
It's incredible,
we're,
man.
We're doing a video for them right now, so I was doing a bunch of art output from it, and it's just such a great tool.
Oh, it's incredible. I love it. I was originally going to make 16,000 of them by hand.
Wow.
So I was just going to do like, I'm going to sit there and make 16,000. And then we had this funny pun, Opepen AI. So yeah. Again, it's like moment in time, you know, the commodification of image making, and did a human make this? Who is responsible for it? Is the person that wrote the prompt? Is it the algorithm that was trained on all this material? Is it the original material? What do you attribute? All this stuff. Yeah, there's so many themes there that I think are kind of not figured out in this whole environment of digital art that we were going to play with originally. And it weirdly turns out that the appetite for that is not that high. The artistic, you know, personal input and handmade, in inverted commas, pieces have resonated, I would say, this is my instinct, resonated far more than any of the AI generated stuff. So again, that hypothesis is like all we really are convinced of over the long term is that we got the silhouette right. And we've made something that's iconic enough that we can iterate on it until 80 people are interested in it 200 yeah. times. And that to me is a high pressure situation to put yourself in, but it also takes a lot of pressure off. You're not trying to open a nightclub. You're not trying to, you know, launch physical collectibles and build supply chains and stuff. Like, you're doing the thing that you started out doing and hopefully creating a reason for people to stay watching the story as it evolves.
Right.
So yeah, it's been a fun one.
Yeah, I think it's really great to watch from an outsider looking in, and especially then when you start pulling in, you know, artists we've seen recently with like Lucas Pudgy Penguins, that one just like went off. And I think it's just like, as you mentioned, that variety, but also that everything's in keeping with each other. Do you know what I mean? Keeps the community together. But also you have, you know, people interested in certain things and allows them to opt in. And that's why, you know, people resonate with it so much. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seemed like an outsider looking in who was watching like the social commentary on your Twitter at the time that like your Pepin open edition wasn't something you really wanted to get too involved in post, you know, the open edition itself. Unlike checks, obviously, where you started mm-hmm. checks as exactly that and it progressed. I always felt from reading just your tweets at the time, the tone of them and maybe how you were answering some people, that you just weren't interested in engaging with anything other than, you know, Pepin being an open edition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. That was the case to begin with. And I think sort of embracing some of those frustrations directly informed the mechanics of it too. Like this idea of having editions within a PFP in inverted commas project, yeah. which we have now changed the description of the OpenSea collection to say this is not a PFP project. You know, it's an art project that you can use as a PFP if you so choose.
Right.
And
is that like your version of NFA?
Like this is yeah, exactly.
Not PFP advice.
Right. This idea of, we got a load of pushback on the, like, there are editions of artwork within this, within some of these collections, right? Like the 40 edition has, well, all of them have multiples potentially if they're print, they're organized as prints. And it just goes back to this idea of falsely ascribing value to the uniqueness of your avatar. Like, I feel like that's kind of a nonsensical. If you want a unique avatar, use a picture of your face. You know, like the thing that I think is greater, or like the thing that produces a more interesting outcome, is making this thing possible for anybody to use. Anybody can take this and signal that they're interested in the values that this community of people are moving in and out of and around, and the utility of that is attracting other people who believe those things, right? And if you limit that to people who own this thing, either with an earring or with a cap or whatever else, it, to me, that doesn't, I mean, Nouns does an incredible job of this too, right? You know, when you see the Nouns goggles on anything, not necessarily even a noun, it's somebody signaling the fact that they value the philosophy of the Nouns community and project. Yeah. And that signal on a open network, Twitter in this for now, is what has, in my experience, led me to create the relationships that now make it possible to build this stuff. Like being able to, and visualize value was foundational to that too. Putting this body of work out there for 2-3 years prior to this, had this network of people that had this like shared vocabulary of all the concepts that Visualize Value had published or reworked or shared. And it's like such a cheat code for making stuff, because you already have dozens and dozens of people with these complementary skill sets that share your views. They just come together and, given the right catalyst, make a ton of stuff. And that's what happened when the derivative explosion of checks and OPEP, and I think are directly connected to that too, where a lot of people want to make stuff. It's just like, give me a, I can't work from a blank page, right? Or
give me something.
Like, to work from a blank page is a totally different challenge than put your spin on this. And internet culture is that.
Yeah, it's like art as a prompt in a way. I've said this a lot about why I think OPEPN is so popular and why Nouns is as well, where like pixel art and OPEPN are both kind of lo-fi. You can sort of see them however you want. You can see yourself in them. Or as you said, you can use them as a prompt to create something where you don't have a blank page in front of you.
Yeah, it's a cult, like the cold start problem for artists. And the longer term goal of OPEPN is, you know, you have this ability to concentrate attention with the official drops, but then you also can reroute that attention to the portfolios of these artists that contribute, right? So if we have a Piv drop a set, that leads attention to his previous body of work, right? The cumulative provenance of all of his work. People want to collect the one of ones, maybe. People want to follow Piv on Twitter. There's like this unifying thing that can attract a bunch of energy and then splinter it off in all these different directions. And that's like the most satisfying thing about this entire exercise is being able to like eat art as a platform that doesn't, everybody probably listening to this has seen artists on Twitter like shouting into the void with a piece of work that is not connected to anything else, right? It's something that they have produced by themselves, probably for good reason, beautiful, meaningful. But there's something about being able to contribute to something that people already value or already looking at.
You could consider it almost like weaponized speculation. You know, it's like using the speculation in a positive way.
Right. The idea that like the attention on this thing is captive versus like attention elsewhere is a lot more passive, and that I don't know, that to me is using it for good is in my mind the best implementation of this technology in the context of art collectibles and like internet communities. Like the community should be making stuff, not just consuming stuff, right? The collective output, I think, of people who are in checks and a pep, and whether or not they even own any of the pieces, the output is crazy. And that is what the network depends upon to grow, is making more stuff and getting it in front of more people.
Brick and mortar museums know this as well, because you know they'll have collections that have beautiful pieces that maybe should attract people to come look at them every day of the year, but yet they'll still have, you know, thematic expositions where they say, come out and see the masters of this century, or come out and see, they know that you have to still get a hook to get people in the door.
Yeah. You got also something new to talk about. Exactly.
Definitely. Jack, you touched on Nouns there, so obviously we need to bring them up. Well, it is the Noun Square and it is the Zero Pod podcast. So you've been in Nouns.
Yeah, we'll get fired. We'll get fired if we don't mention it.
Yeah, exactly. No funding. We'll cut that out. So yeah, you've been part of Nouns since pretty early. I think you got like Noun 141, which I remember because I made when like everybody was like doing the checks edition sort of meta when everybody was making their own. Yeah. I made like a 1-1-4-1-1.
Yeah. Very cool. Thank you.
So yeah, what attracted you to Nouns, and you know, what do you think about the project in general, I guess?
Well, it's a lot of the same themes that I find interesting and trying to explore with OPEPN, this idea of solving the cold start problem for creative, internet native creative people is something that I just watched people struggle with for years. Like visualized value attracts a lot of people who are trying to create network effect for themselves on the internet. And to do that from scratch is very difficult. But if you have this like shared canvas to contribute to that people are incentivized to pay attention to in some way, that like I absolutely saw it as this like massive experiment in incentives. And having worked on something that is so internet native for years prior, I really like the CCO thesis just completely made sense to me then. I was like you need people to amplify this infinitely. Like, if you incentivize that, there's a very interesting potential outcome for that, right? Like, over a long period of time, that is a massive, as a massive potential outcome. I ran an experiment shortly after it was before I had a noun. I like sold caps with the noggles on them. And it's fascinating. I think, you know, a couple hundred caps I sold in an hour or something. That
collector's items out.
Yeah, very cool. I got a few of them left, I think. But that really, I don't know, shifted my perspective on it, where I was like, wow, this is a totally novel, new idea that deserves exploration. And I've got so many people in my network that are looking for a thing to contribute to that doesn't have, you don't have to ask layers and layers and layers of permission to get going. You could just make stuff, throw it out, And there was a lot of people in Visualized Value. A few actually got Nouns props approved and got funded to make some stuff. So I was pressing on that pretty, like trying to explain that to people that were in Visualized Value that were NFT and crypto curious. To me, it's a, you know, again, it's a platform rather than a project. And that idea of what crypto, what the values of crypto can enable, in my mind, is a very pure expression of that. So yeah, proud to be a part of it. And I think over the long, long, long time frame, I think we'll see an appreciation, I think, for the thoughtfulness of it. It is a very interesting mechanism. And obviously you have to get the icon right. That's something that really attracted me to it in the beginning, is like how difficult it is to make something recognizable, reproducible, that doesn't have this like massively high barrier to recreate. And the noggles are ticking all those boxes, right? Yeah. I worked in the like brand building for a long time, and those things are not, you know, they're non-trivial. So if you're able to design the mechanism in a thoughtful way, and you have this mimetic layer on top that satisfies all of those criteria, then the potential outcomes are incredible.
The crazy thing is that if you look back at the actual history of nouns, I don't think the noggles were actually meant to be as much of a mimetic icon as they turned out to be, which almost like lends them even more credence than they otherwise should get, because obviously the aesthetic was very, you know, they put a lot of work into it. And the artists who worked on nouns are incredible, Gremlin and 41 and Timpers and all the rest. But they knew they had something great, and they knew enough to make the noggles pretty much the same throughout the collection in terms of shape and whatnot. But I don't think they quite got how they didn't know people were going to be making podcasts with, you know, physical glasses.
Right.
It's crazy.
No, I think that again, like in a lot of cases, if you set out to do that, that's not what you end up doing. Right. It's like you have to let consensus determine what the, those things can only be determined by the network agreeing upon their value and amplifying it. But
right, you can't just tell everybody your project is the best ever.
Right. Yeah, I think that was one of the coolest things to see after Nouns launch, was the like integration of the noggles in everything. And I think one of the other things I appreciated about it was the name. I wrote a thread about this whenever I got involved.
Back in the day.
Yeah, 18 months ago or something. The
years in NFT terms.
It kind of separates itself from the rest, you know, by being about objects and being like extendable to so many things. Again, it just like amplifies all the possible outcomes. It's not restrained to here's this one anthropomorphic character that we've decided we're going to use, and there's something infinite about the possibility there. And I know that was that, you know, an infinite work of art was how it was launched, and that's I think true.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were trying to tap into some like massive demand for people who wanted to be, you know, a tin of spam or something, you know, like it
right,
wasn't
right.
The absurdity was on purpose, I guess, in that
exactly
sense.
Yeah.
We touched on CC0 just a minute ago, and of course our podcast is called Zero Rights Reserved, so we'd be remiss if we didn't just double click on that for a quick second. I wanted to ask why you've had such an affinity in your career for putting a lot of your work into the public domain, and you know, as a visual artist that can be kind of rare, so I'm curious why you've taken that tack.
Well, one thing, I think the medium is inherently permissionless, right? One of the things that I learned through visualized value was if you make something that people like, they're going to copy it. And the idea that you would spend your resources trying to basically shut down the proliferation of your work in some way is a weighing up that decision is kind of interesting. It's like if you're making shoes or something and people are like knocking off your shoes and like leveraging some of your brand value and diluting your brand, there's a, like, if it's not set up that way from inception, I can totally understand why you would not approve of that. And that was the case for me with visualized value. When I see people knocking that stuff, originally I was so frustrated, but I was like, oh man, this is like, and then you just basically throw your hands up in the air. It's like, how can I even, where do I even begin to go about stopping this happening? Yeah. And then you sort of come to the realization that, no, this is like a behavior that is occurring because you're making something that people want to proliferate in some way. And
it's literally our most innate thing that we do. Like you've got a young one at home too. I've got a 9-month old, and like everything they do is imitation right from the get go.
Yeah.
And that's how we learn.
Yeah. And man, did you guys see that? You might have even tweeted about it. This might even be how I read about it. The guy that generated 3 billion melodies and then copyrighted them all and then released them all into the public domain.
Very cool.
Yeah. Incredible, man. Yeah, I think I have some belief deep down that the value accrues back to like the point of origin in some way, right? And just as a hopefully these things are like completely the antithesis of what most creative people want to spend their time doing too, like the trying to like fence around this stuff. I think there's so many examples in the world of that playing out the wrong way, but there's also I can't argue fully like for everybody doing this, because if you don't have a strong belief that this stuff is adding value to the network that you're creating, then yeah, you shouldn't do it.
Like they even have a term for that, right? The Barbara Streisand effect, or the Streisand effect, where,
right,
you know, she tried to squelch something that was on the internet and it just drew more attention to the
attention to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that at this like moment in time culturally, we're a long way off from this being an accepted practice. Like, this is not something that people are generally excited about doing, but when they get introduced to projects that are like from inception built that way, I think people can get excited about the potential of that. You know, I don't know if the Nouns team ever anticipated what amount of value would be ascribed to these things. Like nobody can even begin to predict that, right? It's like, you don't know whether people are going to want to spend $10 on these things, $100,000. It's just like, it's a really bizarre thing to have the expectations be like put onto you, but like I don't even know how to describe that, right?
It's like why it's like you did this.
Yeah.
you put this value in here, not us.
Right. And the O'Pepin thing only works because it was free. The whole project only works because that thing costs nothing. It's like, we're just running this experiment publicly and you want to engage with it. It's free. Like, you literally don't even have to collect the thing. You don't have to own the thing. You like, feel free to not engage whatsoever. And you can still get 99% of the, you can still consume 99% of the story, or not, like, you know, everything applies to you too.
With nouns, the auction kind of fulfills a similar placeholder where, like, you only paid what you wanted to pay, allegedly. Like, the auction started at zero. So if you paid 600 ETH, you must have wanted to pay that. So you can't really, you know.
It's a fascinating thing. It's a fascinating thing that, again, like, nascent behaviors or, you know, uncharted territory in some ways leads you to this place where the expectations come from things that are out of your control in many ways. And that's, I think, fingers crossed, by setting expectations on what we're going to do and having a date where, well, not even a date, but a set of criteria that at some point will be fulfilled is, you know, by participating in this, you have all the information that you need. This is what we're going to be doing until there are 200 of these things out in the world and this thing will be finished. So trying to kind of take cues or reverse engineer a different mechanism for this thing based on what I've seen happen in other contexts or with other promises. And honestly, I'm in no position to promise the things that these other places are promising. Like I said before, the only thing that we can promise is we'll make art until there's no art left to be made.
What is the VV training bundle? I think you touched on it at the beginning, but somebody was asking, you know, what is it and what can they expect from it?
Yeah, so there's two programs in there. One's called How to Visualize Value, which is basically breaking down this process of how do you take a idea and add visual context to it. So it's probably like it might take you a day to go through that, and it will just give you the starting, you know, the building blocks of how to work on producing that style of visual. Mm-hmm. And the second piece is called Build Once, Sell Twice. So
not to be confused with Measure Once, Cut Twice. That's what I usually do when I'm doing my carpentry project.
Exactly. Not to be confused with that. Build Once, Sell Twice, like a meta layer on top of that. So it's like if you have a skill set and you're trying to put something out on the internet that represents what you can do or what result you can produce for someone. So it's describing the transition from service business to product business as a creative.
What else have we got here? Somebody asked, in the future, how would you look back on a pep in and say, you know, this project was a success because?
I think definitely what we talked about with other artists getting a platform, you know, if you could kickstart artist careers or get some momentum onto other artists, get people who don't consider themselves to be artists to contribute to that set.
We've seen some of that already, haven't we?
Yeah. Document moments in time. Like, I'm most excited to look at the, you know, stand back from the whole thing and see how things evolve aesthetically, if at all, you know, like, depending on how long this thing takes. Look at like Stable Diffusion in set 2, for example. Like, by set 100, what is the difference in image output there? Or what, like, how far can the form be reduced, experimented with, played with? How abstract can we get with it? Just, I think variety and there's a lot of just so many unknowns of how many directions this can go in that as long as we get the 200 out, I'm going to be fascinated by what they end up being.
To see somebody like do a set and then go like, you know, stratospheric or be the next like Beeple or something will be so like, you know, I can imagine it could happen. You're going to have like, you know, 200 sets, and to see that must be like it'd be like a feather in your cap, or you'd look back and be like, yeah, that was really something.
100%. Yeah. I think
it has that provenance, because you can be like you say, we've spoken about this whole show. You've got that provenance, go, oh, this person is a relatively unknown person. You know, they're going to have some sort of, you know, they're going to know them a little bit because they've managed to get set out from you doing a pep in. But I mean, to go from like a base level to being like, well, we call them famous, you know, I mean, whether it's from Web 2 or Web 3, it'll be like,
right,
crazy good.
I'll be like, not to brag, but I was friends with Ripe before he was famous. So,
I'm telling you, man, there's so many just insanely talented people hovering around this stuff. And that, again, they have distribution among their peers, and something like this can bring new eyes to their work and introduce new people to the way they think. Like, the amount of talent in a number, like a large number of individuals that are in these couple of communities is just mind bending. And like even filtering through it or like queuing it all up is a Herculean task. There's so much of it. Like that's the, we have a more of a like oversupply problem than an undersupply problem. So
good problem to have.
Good
place to be.
One question that someone asked was, have you ever considered linking a physical piece to an OPEPN set? I thought that was a cool question.
There's like nothing really off, you know, nothing that we wouldn't not consider, like if it's reasonable enough. I think there's a lot of interesting things that can be done there. Even collaborating with a maker of physical objects to produce the artwork in the set too, you know. I really, there's something magic about this little number of 82 where you can, there's probably, I don't know what the unique ownership is, probably around 50, 60 people in each. It's like a very, very good number for conversations to happen that don't get overwhelming, but also you can really spotlight very niche types of art or artists because that's as many people as you need to want the thing for it to be, you know, for it to be a part of the overall collection. So open to ideas on that front for sure.
I know a couple of people were working on potential OPEPENGU glasses. I know
I've seen Savino
was working on that, and someone else. It'd be cool to have them as a physical claim, and maybe you have to own one of the OPEPE Pengus to claim them or something.
Yeah, there's the Pudgy Penguins did a hoodie for it for that drop too, which is going to be great.
Did they? I didn't know that. That's cool.
Yeah, it's coming out soon, I think. So I'll send you boys.
Luca's amazing for that stuff. We've had he was actually our first guest on this pod, but he's amazing.
He's always churning something out, man.
he's a busy dude. We got a couple more questions here. I think this one's a bit broad, but what next for Chex and OPEPN and for Jack Butcher? So maybe because it's such a large question and we've sort of spoke about Chex a bit, like, what next for you? Whether it's like, you know, personal stuff or, you know, in the ecosystem, you're obviously slammed at the minute. You know, what's next for you, my man?
185 OPEPN sets. And that I think some one of one stuff, like trying to, you know, pull yourself out of that and get back to some of the visualized value stuff to punctuate this experience is definitely part of the goal too. Is don't want to lose the DNA of this while we're building something that, you know, is massive, but at the same time will be one project in a hopefully a long string of projects. And and that, like, the number is so intimidating, but at the same time, I don't know, that I really am trying to get in this headspace of what's next, because there will be something new to comment on. You know, there's Chex is a Chex captured this very specific moment in time, or Pepin's designed to do the same, albeit over a longer period of time. And then, you know, projects that have a like fresh ability to comment on something new is definitely in the, you know, in the pipeline, something that I aspire to do, right? This world is not going to stop at Chex and OPEPN. There's always, it's just a pure resource problem right now.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever look at OPEPN and be like, you know, what have I done? Like, do you ever?
There has been occasions, yeah.
Like, was 100 not enough? Like,
what? No, originally the plan was 100, but I'm like, that's not, that's 160%, not 80.
Yeah, you know, so, checkout.
Exactly, mate. Yeah. No, so it's a beast, but at the same time, it's like a privilege to have something that has focused attention on it. So the tension there is justifiable. You know, like sometimes I do stare at it and I'm like, you know, when people post the grid, like people have like mocked up the grid of the 15. I'm like, that's a lot. That is a lot. But we're like, my background, how many things you make to get to the final thing.
Yeah.
It's like been a huge part of how I've worked for such a long time. And
well, you've done it in public too. So we've seen it.
Yeah. And I think some of this stuff is also, I'm working towards this. This is not something that comes that naturally to me, but almost getting less precious with some of it because we have the consensus mechanism built in, right? It's like, let's put more, like, let's do more volume and let's see what people want.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we probably have enough community submitted sets to put 20 or 30 of them out at once if we wanted to. Yeah, it's more of a case
I want to see one fail, you know. I want to see what the community doesn't want. I don't want I feel bad for that artist, but I mean, it's part of the process, right?
And it's and it's again a trying to sort of destigmatize that too. Like, if it didn't work for that reason, come back, do something new. Like, let's iterate on it.
And like I say, that artist could be the one that like goes ahead in like 10 years and becomes mega famous, and then you've got that provenance of however you put it, that saying provenance of time, is it?
Yeah, I would say time provenance of their submission.
Yeah.
We'll see. Nouns, we meme that a little bit too. When people have a proposal that gets defeated, and when you look at the actual site, there's like this red rectangle that says defeated in like friendly Londrina font. It's like defeated.
Yeah.
And so we've joked about like making hats for people and like really leaning into it. Like, you know, like you that, said,
it's not the worst thing.
Not the worst thing in the world. There was one other question here from the community, which I think actually is sometimes interesting. Have you read any good books lately in your spare time? Is there anything you've read that you'd share?
I have not read a book in a long... You know what? I bought a bunch of Buckminster Fuller books. So the guy that came up with the geodesic dome. Just like absolute like giga genius beyond... beyond comprehension. Mm. There's one called this book's called Synergetics. It's like the theory of everything. It's like all of these geometric patterns in nature that have been diagrammed out.
That's pretty cool.
Energy transfer, just like stuff that is way beyond my ability to understand. But I like picked that up. And one of the purposes it serves to me is like, wow, not one person, but there's like. Somebody was in charge of producing this as a body of work, and it's incredibly sort of humbling to look at something like that as like, wow, like this is one book that this guy produced in like a body of work of probably 20 or 30 of them, along with being an architect, a lecturer, a just you name it, modern day
that keeps you grounded,
polymath.
I love stuff like that because it speaks to the human experience, because humans in our evolution have had a really strong connection to patterns, right? Where all of what we do is all around pattern recognition, whether it was like hunting or whether it was like, gathering berries from it's all pattern recognition. And they've done studies to show that like humans can pick up human faces, for example, in like the minutest light impression of a human face in this mosaic, because it's just what we've been doing for millions of years. And so I love stuff like what you just mentioned, where we look back on nature and we find all those patterns. And it's kind of similar to what you were saying in the opening of this pod, where you were saying, I'm looking back on my life and I'm drawing all these lines. And who knows if those lines were, you know, the actual path, but it doesn't really matter when you're looking backwards. Yeah. We find those patterns, we draw them.
Unknowable. And this guy's actually got a book called Pattern Thinking as well. Interesting you mentioned that. Yeah, it's like, I know a lot of this, this Opepin stuff has gotten very philosophical. We're 15 sets in, you know, and the people who are submitting these things, and we've held ourselves to a massively high conceptual standard on this stuff, where we're trying to really make a point with a lot of this stuff. And I don't know, it's introduced me to a lot of great thinkers, writers, and almost all of them sort of converge on this idea of like, you cannot separate things. Like you can't pull one field away from another field. Everything has this like interconnection. And I like to think of that as like a great analogy for what we're trying to do with Opepin, right? It's like you have this very, very recognizable shape, and you could give that as a brief to an architect or a baker or a, you know, pianist. It's like, go and make something that is like, just uses this DNA and fuse it with yours. And like the number of outcomes are infinite. So yes, yeah, it's led me down some interesting philosophical rabbit holes, and a lot of people who the last set that Giles did, the Da Vinci set.
Yeah.
It kind of led us there too. It was like, everything is connected to everything else. Like if you want to study art, you got to study science. And it almost becomes like, to go back to your question about what would you want this to look like when it's done? I think this should be such a rich thing to consume in hindsight. where you can be introduced to ideas, to thinkers, to artists that died 400 years ago, or like a technologist that just figured something out yesterday through this set of 200 things. And we have ambitions for like expanding that beyond the 16,000 official pieces too. And like, one of the things that I think is totally underexplored in Ethereum in general is like this ability to connect things that exist outside of the quote unquote official ecosystem, but like, oh, here's a derivative of this set. And then here's a derivative of this set, and like try and map this visual consciousness in a much more comprehensive way, and encourage like this whole mint everything idea, like the collective consciousness of Opepen being like, we encourage much more like permanence around that. Like,
yeah,
you had this idea that was informed by that set, you should mint it, and we want to give you a way in the front end on opepen.art to link it to that set, right? And if I'm just browsing the site, I can go to that set and then I can scroll down and I can see derivatives. I can go there and I'll look at your profile and I'll see all your Opepen derivatives. And then I'll see maybe your one of one collection, maybe this edition that you just launched. Maybe I can get to your Twitter from there. So
you're literally going down the rabbit hole at that point, you know?
Right. Exactly. That's a great analogy for it. So yeah, all of this stuff is like in V0 right now. The challenge has way more to do with our resources than the ideas we have to make this stuff happen. So there's a lot of stuff in the pipeline being built that we get ideas every day from just how people are interacting with it on Twitter. Sorry, I'm off on a tangent. The other thing I'll mention is like, you see like somebody introduce a new style or like find a new way to interpret the silhouette.
Yeah.
And then it just starts to like proliferate. You wake up the next day and somebody's done like a V 1.1, right? The V1.2. Yeah. And then like when Ripe did the dithered Zorb, yeah, it was like all these dithered explorations came out on the timeline. Yeah. It's just like to lose all of that to these platforms that don't have the ability to make those connections would be a tragedy, I think. So it's gonna be a big archival process, I think, to go back and pick up some of this stuff. But
so what you're saying is mint as much as possible, because it'll make it a lot easier for Jack to find it later when he's...
Yeah, exactly right. That's exactly what I'm saying.
When you just talked about looking back on Opepen as a project once it's all finished, one thing that you touched on is sort of the collaborative nature of Opepen, how like so many people are involved in making this happen already. And by the time you get to the last set, it will have been hundreds of maybe even 1,000 people who've contributed and collaborated on this project, which is pretty unique as well. I remember hearing the founder of Eigenlayer on a podcast recently, Sriram, and he talked about how his background was in biology, actually. And he talked about like he looked at how cells would like collaborate basically to do things, and then he ended up switching and getting into blockchain, and he kind of parsed it in the way of saying like he realized at a certain point in time that like blockchain was, you know, to the organization of cells in biology for humans. I probably didn't express that very well, but saying like it just empowers humans to collaborate in a way that they've never been able to do before.
Yeah, there's something like fundamentally, naturally interesting about this to people that, going back to the 56K analogy, you're like, you believe it or you're on the other side of it or you aren't. Mm-hmm. And there's another guy who wrote this on Twitter years ago. Man, I'm going to have to get you his name. But he said, merge fields, nature is the only industry.
There we
go. Yeah.
Reminds me, like everything is, you know, you get down whatever philosophical rabbit hole on that, but there are these fundamental truths that you can use to build structures around to kind of expose the way people are naturally behaving, and just trying to like offer a little bit of organization, you know, design as a layer to kind of coordinate that natural behavior is a really compelling thing to spend time on, for sure.
And a great counter argument to people who are, you know, just viscerally against blockchain or crypto or against NFTs for whatever you know, reason that they may have. But when you frame it as like a way to coordinate humans and to collaborate versus a way to speculate and try to get rich and scam each other, it's such an easier sell.
Mm-hmm.
We'll hopefully. Get that.
Yeah.
We'll get that.
There. I mean, yeah, transparency is a steep hill to climb right now, for sure. But like, the beautiful thing about this has been, if nobody else ever gets involved in it, we could still finish it.
That's right.
Exactly.
You know, like that to me is, yeah, that to me is very reassuring that we have all the ingredients required. The opt-in stuff's going to be interesting, how we have to modify that with, obviously the opt-in has to, the demand right now, the requirement is the same as set one, but there's obviously less supply with which people can opt in. So
right,
it's actually harder to get a set through currently.
This is like what Nouns or other DAOs struggle with in terms of quorum, where like it's like a moving target where you want to make sure a sufficient percentage of your holders are voting on things. But at a certain point in time, like maybe that waxes and wanes for how many people are just around in the first place. You know, so you might say, oh, we want 30% of people to vote on something, but what if only 40% of your holders are even here? You know, anyways, it's kind of getting into a rabbit hole. Final question, and we'll let you go, because I think this is a good one to finish off on. What is your best advice for any young artists? They don't have to be young, any aspiring artists listening to this and seeing you as a role model, someone who's found success. What advice would you give them?
I would say contribute to these open networks, like in order to get your work in front of people. There's kind of these two parallel paths, like making the stuff that is inherently interesting to you. And then in my mind, adding a layer of you to these networks that already operate that way, that allow for your permissionless contribution. Make an O'Pepin set is the TLDR, right? Or you go contribute to Nouns, go and get involved in these communities that have an appreciation for something already and add your flavor of contribution to that. And then outside of any of that is just publish and produce consistently. Xcopy's got one of my favorite quotes about being an artist. I don't know if I'm going to say this verbatim, but it was like, you want to be a better artist, make more art. Nobody wants to hear that. Nobody wants to hear that answer. You want some like magical bean.
Yeah,
but there are no magical beans.
You want to be a better cook? Stuff. Make more, make more meals.
Yeah,
exactly that.
Yeah, and I think the reason why in the context of digital art that is tough is people conflate the scarcity idea with the production idea. Like, look at a Beeple. He makes something every day. Not everything gets turned into a collectible piece of work.
Right.
And that, in order to participate in the internet as an artist, unless you have, you know, entered 0.001% territory, you have to keep making stuff for people to look at.
Yep. Well, that's one good one thing is built into O'Pepin. So we'll be looking at O'Pepins for a long time to come until they're all done.
We will.
Jack, I want to thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Sorry we went a little bit long, but I kind of expected that because you're always so interesting to listen to.
Yeah, it was good one.
That was a great chat. Thanks, boys.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate your time. That's right.
Cardinal's back to Weatherspoons now, isn't he?
It's literally around the corner as well. Like, but no, it's not my usual.
How long do you need to get there? I think for me, it's like a 12-hour flight. When we meeting tomorrow for lunch? Yeah.
It's not worth the flight, mate. I'll come to you.
Pints on Cardinal. Cool. I'll fly.
Yeah. All right.
So we'll get this edited out and probably go up early next week. So.
All right, boys. Thank you very much for your time. Yeah, cheers. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a good one.